Chapter 9. Jeffrey Epstein, Renfield to the globalist Draculas, but even worse, because they prey on their own children. I believe that understanding the Jeffrey Epstein story is like unlocking the Rosetta Stone to comprehend the way our world really works. I could begin by telling you exactly what I think happened in this story, but I don't think you're ready for it. Instead, I'm going to tell you the story as the mainstream media told it, then pick apart the inconsistencies until you understand how their account makes absolutely no sense, and you'll be more likely to consider my version. Where should we begin the Jeffrey Epstein story? Should we begin it with the resignation of Trump's Labor Secretary, Alex Acosta, in 2019, for failing to properly prosecute Jeffrey Epstein in 2008? This is how it was described in the pages of the New York Times. President Trump's embattled Labor Secretary, R. Alexander Acosta, announced his resignation on Friday amid continuing questions about the handling of a sex crimes case involving the financier Jeffrey Epstein when Mr. Acosta was a federal prosecutor in Florida. Mr. Trump, who announced the resignation, said Mr. Acosta had called him on Friday morning to tell the president he planned to step down. Mr. Acosta's decision came only 2 days after he held a news conference to defend his handling of the 2008 sex crimes prosecution of Mr. Epstein while trying to quell a chorus of Democratic calls for his resignation and convincing Mr. Trump he was strong enough to survive. If that's all you read about the story, you'd probably just shrug your shoulders and say to yourself, "It seems like something weird was going on, but I'm sure happy that prosecutor who didn't do his job in 2008 finally suffered some consequences." Then you move on to the next fake news story. But we shouldn't be so quick to abandon the story of Alex Acosta. One of the few investigative journalists who aggressively pursued the Jeffrey Epstein story over the years was Julie K. Brown, an award-winning investigative reporter for the Miami Herald. The Epstein case was initially investigated by Detective Joe Ricari, who would quickly find himself embroiled in the most unusual case of his career. As Brown detailed the early maneuverings of the Epstein case, it seemed that a formidable army was being assembled to defend the wealthy pedophile. Epstein hired the flamboyant Harvard lawyer Alan Dershowitz, who met with Barry Krischer, the Palm Beach state attorney responsible for prosecuting the case. Soon, criminal prosecutors were no longer scrutinizing Epstein. They were excoriating his underage victims. Over the course of a year, everything Ricari believed about justice was shaken to its core. Krischer, seemingly dazzled by Dershowitz's fame, would turn his back on the victims and the police working the case. Epstein and the private investigators hired by his lawyers stalked and threatened the girls and their families, tearing their lives apart. Ultimately, the FBI would take over the investigation. The man who would oversee the case was a young, rising star in the Republican Party who had ambitions to become a U.S. Supreme Court justice. Rene Alexander Acosta, 37, was sworn in as U.S. attorney in Miami in October 2006, just as the FBI began to suspect that Epstein's crimes went well beyond South Florida. Let's consider the initial moves in this drama. Evidence is assembled by an honest Florida detective, and charges are brought against Epstein. Now, the machinery of Epstein's defense swings into action. Epstein is able to get famed Harvard lawyer Alan Dershowitz on his side. Dershowitz apparently dazzles the Palm Beach state attorney and gets him to turn his investigative team on the underage victims rather than Epstein. I applaud Brown's work, but there's something with which I take serious exception. Brown claims the Palm Beach state attorney was likely dazzled by Dershowitz, and that explains his action. Can Brown provide me any proof for that claim? Or is that what one says when they don't have any evidence for why a law enforcement official would take the side of an alleged pedophile. And while Brown is definitely staying in the shallow end of the investigative pool, she suggests that whatever nefarious methods were at work on the Democratic side of the aisle, they were equally at work on the Republican side. Epstein had given liberally to Democratic candidates and causes, but he knew that if he wanted the Republicans then in the White House in his corner, he needed someone with clout in Washington. His legal dream team included Kenneth Starr, the former independent counsel who had employed his skills of moral outrage and prosecutorial skill to make the case for President Bill Clinton's 1998 impeachment, citing a solemn intent to ensure fairness and integrity in the administration of justice. Starr asked the Justice Department to essentially quash the federal case the prosecutors in Miami were mounting against Epstein. When the media goes after me for my conspiracy theories, I just want to stop them and say, people, don't you have even a shred of skepticism in your souls? Have you spent years among the lying political class, and you still swallow the latest bit of garbage as if it's a filet mignon? Does Kenneth Starr want us to believe that he spent 4 years investigating Clinton, only coming up with blowjobs by Monica Lewinsky, an adult intern at the White House, and yet Jeffrey Epstein, having sex with underage girls, was a model of moral rectitude that should be freed? You might be surprised to hear me say this, but I'm inclined to give 37-year-old Alex Acosta, the newly sworn-in U.S. attorney in Miami, a break. From my experience of how public officials are corrupted, it's usually only when they've reached a high level that the curtain is pulled back and they see how the show is really run. My suspicion is that the Epstein case was when the curtain was first pulled back a little for Acosta. That explains this allegation, which appeared in Newsweek and didn't get much traction at the time, but which starts to put the pieces together for me. New allegations from the Daily Beast and journalist Vicky Ward reported that Acosta told the Trump administration during the screening process for his current role that he was asked to cut a deal with Epstein because he was told the financier belonged to intelligence and that the issue was above his pay grade. That explanation makes a great deal of sense to me and is consistent with what I have been told about the operations of the deep state. There was 37-year-old Alex Acosta, the newly minted U.S. attorney in Miami, and suddenly he's facing off against Alan Dershowitz, Kenneth Starr, and these nameless officials telling him this is an intelligence matter that is above his pay grade. What do you do if you're interested in continuing your ascent to become a U.S. Supreme Court justice? You back off when the spooky man tells you to back off. What do you know about intelligence matters? You're a new U.S. attorney, ignorant of such matters, and you get what I'm assuming were top intelligence officials telling you to drop the case. You probably do exactly what they tell you to do. Despite Acosta doing what he was told in the Epstein case, I get the impression he wasn't really favored by the intelligence community for recruitment. He seemed to be loyal to Trump in his job, and when the Epstein story got hot, he got scapegoated and sacrificed. That's not generally how the intelligence community treats its own. Or should the story start in 2007, when Jeffrey Epstein was first charged with sex trafficking crimes in Florida, and his attorney, Alan Dershowitz, claimed to the court that Epstein was part of the original brain trust for the Clinton Global Initiative, writing, "Mr. Epstein was part of the original group that conceived the Clinton Global Initiative, which is described as a project bringing together a community of global leaders to devise and implement innovative solutions to some of the world's most pressing challenges," attorney Alan Dershowitz and Gerald Lefcourt wrote in the letter, which was first reported by Fox News in 2016 and resurfaced Monday by the Daily Caller. Was the plan to say to the judge, "Yes, Your Honor, we know he's a pedophile, but look at all this good work he's doing for the world. Or should we start with the cameras, allegedly in his properties in Manhattan, Little St. James Island in the Caribbean, and Zorro Ranch in New Mexico? Jeffrey Epstein had surveillance cameras filming every room in his Manhattan mansion and Little St. James estate, and a dedicated employee who monitored the feeds at all times. The home base for his operations in New York City was actually described by former sex slave Virginia Roberts in a memoir she submitted as evidence during her defamation case against Ghislaine Maxwell. The claim of surveillance cameras and other odd accessories at an Epstein property was corroborated by Eddie Aragon, a local New Mexico radio station owner who interviewed Epstein's architect and a former IT contractor who worked on Epstein's internet systems between 1999 and 2007. The Sun reported that the underground floor measures 8,000 square feet, 743 square meters, and has rooms for working out, getting a massage, as well as a jacuzzi area that later made way for a pool. The plan also shows three mechanical rooms. Ms. Farmer, 51, said these areas were where Epstein and Maxwell's computers and video gear were stored. All of that in the basement feels more like a dungeon with the nebulous mechanical rooms, he said. A 6-foot by 6-foot oversized portrait of Ghislaine Maxwell, with her legs fully spread, completely naked, and a golden dagger in her right hand, was dead center in the elevator hall of the basement. I think that was used to intimidate the young women, who were there alone and isolated, he added. The contractor who supplied the photographs stated that he can't ever get the image out of his mind, and it is one of the most bizarre things that he's ever seen. There are so many unbelievable parts to the Jeffrey Epstein story that it can be difficult to hold all of the competing pieces in your mind. Many books have been written about Epstein, and I don't know that any has fully captured what I believe about the man and his evil network. I will do my best to present what I believe was going on with Jeffrey Epstein, but until all of his files, pictures, and videos are released, every one of us is guessing. One might be tempted, as several former Dalton School alumni have, to joke that the school had an Epstein-Barr problem. The joke may not make sense to you unless you understand that Jeffrey Epstein first entered New York society due to being hired as a math teacher by Dalton School headmaster Donald Barr, and Epstein exited that same society under the auspices of his son, William Barr, who, as Attorney General under Trump, declared that Epstein's death while in detention at a secure federal prison in New York City was a suicide. In an article on his time at the Dalton School, the New York Times wrote, "Dalton has long been known for its rigorous academics, repeatedly ranking among the nation's best private schools, while drawing the sons and daughters of New York titans of finance, media, and art. Among the alumni are the CNN journalist Anderson Cooper, the actress Claire Danes, and the comedian Chevy Chase. Mr. Epstein's time at Dalton was brief, and an administrator said it ended in a dismissal. While Mr. Epstein later developed a reputation in the world of finance as a man of brilliance, he was a Brooklyn guy with a motor for a brain," New York Magazine wrote about him in a 2002 profile. The administrator told the Times that he had dismissed Mr. Epstein for poor performance. But the accounts offer a window into Mr. Epstein's early adulthood, before he developed extensive private wealth that allowed him to acquire a $56 million mansion just a mile south of the Dalton School. It was there, prosecutors said this week, that Mr. Epstein and his employees paid numerous underage girls to engage in sex acts with him. If you'll allow me, I need to add some context to this article so that you can better understand what I believe is happening. If you understand the history of the Office of Strategic Services, which later became the Central Intelligence Agency, you'll know that the intelligence agencies were basically a creation of Ivy League graduates from the East Coast, who used their alumni networks to recruit those whom they believed would share their worldview. I also have to add to the picture that, among the elite, there's often a healthy appreciation for the eccentrics or visionaries who see the world in a slightly different light. Most innovation is driven by unusual and eccentric people, or, as George Bernard Shaw might say, the unreasonable man who will not conform himself to the ways of the world, but seeks to change the world to fit his perceptions. That's why, at a surface level, the eccentric or the visionary might believe their true home is among these elites. The culture is quite welcoming to those who feel ill at ease in the rest of the world. The intelligence operatives hiding among the elites want you to fly your freak flag. But it's a trap, just the way a farm is a trap to the well-fed and cared-for turkey, not realizing that Thanksgiving is just around the corner. Consider this description of Donald Barr from the New York Times. In a school known for creativity, administrators prohibited denim jeans and bizarre and eccentric costumes. If Mr. Barr caught students using marijuana, he would often send them to therapy as a condition of staying in school. He himself described his leadership style as "buy you case," using the Imperial Russian term for an edict from the Tsar. Staff members would sometimes turn students away from their morning classes, girls for skirts that were too short, and boys for hair that was too long. Some students balked at the constraints. Still, the school continued to draw families of fame. Around the years of Mr. Epstein's tenure, records show, the student roster included Prudence Murdoch, the daughter of the media mogul Rupert Murdoch, the fashion designer Jill Stewart, and several future actresses, including Jennifer Grey, Tracy Pollan, and Maggie Wheeler. While Mr. Barr was strict on the school culture, he made it a point to hire teachers from unconventional backgrounds, recalled Susan Semmel, a social studies teacher at Dalton from the 1960s to the 1980s, who later wrote a book on the history of the school. Barr didn't care about credentials as long as you were interesting and knew your stuff, Mrs. Semmel said. It's remarkable how much Donald Barr fits the profile of a competent administrator or an intelligence recruiter. He'd be well placed to identify the most promising new members of the elite, as well as their biggest potential enemies. Does it seem as if I'm being too hard on dear Donald Barr, father to William Barr? One needs to read the dispatches of the enemy, as they often let slip important pieces of information, as did this obituary in the New York Times from February 2004 for the elder Barr. Donald Barr, who was born in Manhattan on August 2, 1921, majored in mathematics and anthropology at Columbia, graduating in 1941. He went into the Army and served with the Office of Strategic Services in Washington and Europe. There's really no other way to state it than to say Donald Barr was CIA, even before the CIA came into existence. In her book on Jeffrey Epstein, author Julie K. Brown painted this picture of Barr. In 1974, Epstein was hired as a mathematics teacher at the Dalton School, one of the most prestigious prep schools in New York, catering to children of the wealthy. Though he had no college degree, he was nevertheless hired by headmaster Donald Barr, the father of William Barr, who would become U.S. Attorney General under Presidents George H.W. Bush and Donald Trump. Former teachers at the school said Barr was an eccentric but strict taskmaster who liked hiring people, such as Epstein, who were unconventional choices. Barr himself didn't exactly fit the mold of headmaster of a top private school. In 1973, he published a science fiction novel, Space Relations, about a planet of wealthy aliens who kidnap humans and force them into sex slavery. God forgive me, but I found the idea of William Barr's father writing a science fiction novel about humans kidnapped into having sex with aliens, maybe you write about what you know, to be so outlandishly absurd that I spent $112.81 on Amazon to get an old mass market paperback version of the book, as well as $49.99 for a paperback copy of his second science fiction masterpiece, A Planet in Arms. Are you as immature as I am? And dying to read a few passages from Barr's books? Okay, because you asked me, here's what you'd read on the back cover of his first book, Space Relations, focused on sex between decadent, wealthy alien slavers and their human captives. On a distant planet in the distant future, when all the galaxies are colonized, John Craig, a young space diplomat, is captured by interplanetary pirates and sold into slavery. On Kossar, where boredom and absolute power have driven the rulers to a special kind of madness, Craig is auctioned off to the exquisite Lady Morgan Sidney, a beautiful, sensual woman. He soon makes his way from the hellish slave mines into her bed, in the tower of her castle. And it is here, under the strange castle, that he finds the secret that may bring about the end of man in the galaxy. Almost sounds like a classic story, doesn't it? A young man, kidnapped by pirates, and sold as a slave to work in the mines, but who finds his way to the bed of a beautiful, sensual woman. Here's an excerpt from Space Relations when John Craig and Lady Morgan Sidney first become lovers. The door opened and her ladyship strode in, alone. She still wore the holster belt over the scarlet tunic. Her face, still smudged, was now in repose. She jammed her hands into the side pockets of the tunic and swung around the room. So, this was the fellow's boudoir, she said softly. Not a nice man. Dr. Curie, a squeed room. The lady. No wonder he wouldn't show it to us when we came yesterday. Distinctly a squeed room. There was an unhealthy brilliance to the colors, and something else. Dr. Curie. Before the sorting out, the erection of Narcissus. The lady went to the night table and twitched open the drawer. Yes. She took out a small carved bottle with a tiny golden chalice. Here. She held the bottle out to the doctor. Her eyes were hard. Is that a toilet in there? Get rid of this. Every molecule. Can you use my blast pistol on the bottle without setting the place on fire? Dr. Curie. I think so. He took the bottle and the weapon and disappeared. Craig started struggling to his feet. The lady said sharply, Stay there. Craig. May I know what your ladyship intends to do with me? She ignored the question. The doctor returned and held out the weapon for her. She dropped it into the holster. Dr. Curie, with your permission, I shall go over to headquarters and see whether my influence extends to some kitchen somewhere. Will your ladyship join me? The lady, as you know, I like the salt of hunger. Dr. Curie, until whenever, then. He bowed and rolled out. Her ladyship locked the door. Craig, may I not know what your ladyship intends to do with me? She looked down at him with eyes the color of smoke, slid the harness of her tunic and the tunic off her arms, letting the gear fall to the floor, and stood, scratched, muddy, and glowing through the rents in her thin black suit. Then she suddenly clapped her hands and laughed happily. I just realized, she said, I forgot all about those lieutenants in the safe. and there can't be much air left in there. Well, never mind them. It'll save trouble. She was poised above him. Her face took on a fiercer amusement. The pale gold hair cascaded over it. Her whisper fell on his skin. As to your insolent question, slave, the answer is four things. Can we talk about extreme creepiness? This is a woman who laughs at leaving people to die and delights in having sex with a helpless slave. And she's supposed to be one of the two heroes of the book. What went on in the twisted mind of the man who hired Jeffrey Epstein and fathered Bill Barr? Or how about this sensuous coupling of the young lovers as depicted by Donald Barr? How much does it turn your stomach? The lady. You look so ridiculous, gasping and sputtering like that. Craig. If your ladyship succeeds in drowning me, I won't be much further use. The lady. That's true. Women are at a disadvantage when it comes to necrophilia. But I was getting tired of you anyway. You cloy. You do have talent, though. What I might do is put out your eyes and let you replace Blind Will in the PPC. He's getting old. We'd see how long your tenderness lasts. Craig thought of the tan-skinned young slaves he had seen and Black Whedon in the PPC doing 10 women a day. PPC? The lady. Planned Parenthood Center. It's in the clinic over by the wall. Craig. I think I understand, except why put out Will's eyes, your ladyship? The lady. Oh, we didn't put out his eyes. He blew them out repairing a machine or something. We had lost the slave who was there before, and this seemed like a job a blind man could do. But it would help to be blind, I should think. Most of the slave women are homely. You close your eyes when you're kissing anything, anyway. You're so romantic. Meanwhile, get up there on that rock. Craig obeyed. The lady, lie back, close your eyes. Craig obeyed. He heard the quick sough as her body left the water to join him. His bright lids were shadowed. He waited for her descent. She seemed to pause above him. He opened one eye. Her face was just above his. She was frowning down at him like a child trying to read a grown-up's book. Close your eyes, she snapped. He closed his eye. A few drops of cool water were falling from her mane onto his face. But one drop was warm. It fell on his upper lip. Unbelievingly, he stretched up the tip of his tongue and tasted it. It was salt. The salt of the earth, not the bitumen of the Kosar Sea. He felt a swift, feathery kiss on each eyelid. Then, damn your eyes, and she was her usual self. Now, I can't say that this provides any evidence that Donald Barr was ever involved in any alien or human sex slavery. But what can be said is that he did seem to have an unhealthy fascination with it. The great secret beneath the castle was kept from destroying the universe. Earth and Kosar decided to sign a treaty, abolish slavery, and form something of a league of planets, although it seems Kosar will be a colony of Earth. Nothing like a little Western space imperialism, right? As one of the main Kosarian characters explained, I am fond of empires. A nation is to an empire as a word is to a sentence. You may use that in your own oratory. I shall not need it again. We shall do well as a Terran colony. Several of the conditions that normally disturb the working relations between a mother country and a colony are absent. To take one instance, empires like to place the most annoying restrictions on the brutality of colonists towards indigenous populations. If we had autochthons on Kosar, we should, of course, be very brutal towards them. But we have not got any, and our imported substitutes have prudently been taken away from us in advance. We are of use to Earth, moreover, not for economic, but for military reasons, and history shows that such colonies are generally the best treated. It is in vain that the Earth ambassador has been pursing his lips deprecatingly, and the honorable delegates arranging their features in grimaces of surprise. Such is the tendency of our situation. I conclude, an empire is a good thing when wisely used. But how to acquire wisdom, I have not the time to tell you. We must go to the second and final agenda of this joint session. For those who can't wait for their copy of Space Relations to arrive in the mail, the second and final agenda was the romantic signing of the contract of matrimony, Form B, monogamous relations between John Craig and Lady Morgan Sidney. Doesn't every man want to subdue a former planet and then marry his former torturer? Because if you can't fall in love with your former sex slave master, who can you fall in love with? It's like the Jeffrey Epstein story, but with a happy ending. He and Ghislaine Maxwell get married and live on the French Riviera. This is how Donald Barr's second book, A Planet in Arms, was described on its back cover. A bloody star war had left the tiny planet of Rohan seething with chaos. People swarmed in violent mobs and the government rocked with turmoil. And one man, Carl Ap Ries, would stop at nothing to use the confusion to seize power for himself. Only two people could stop him. Citizen S. Wells, the woman they call the Little Bitch, and her trusted agent, Conrader, the brute of a man who loved her. Then, on the violent penal colony of Lang's Land, the revolution began. A terrifying, murderous civil war that could bring the battered planet to ultimate peace, or devastating ruin. Does this sound as unbearably bad to you as it does to me? Almost like a B-grade, misogynistic Star Wars? The book itself is all about power, which is interesting to me given Barr's occupation as an educator. Shouldn't an educator be concerned with truth rather than power? The book was published in 1981, and the cover, with a green, crater-pocked moon and a Luke Skywalker-type character with a beautiful woman hanging onto his shoulder, as well as a distant image of a black-clad figure around a half-circle-shaped table with his military leaders, evokes a definite Star Wars vibe. Let's see if Barr's prose had gotten any better in the 8 years since his Alien and Human Sex Slavery book. General Holcott R. McGifford had been co-opted from the staff to act as Minister of Armies and Marine. He did not like his colleagues in the cabinet, did not trust them, and intended to have very little more to do with them, but meanwhile had been instructed to report on the heavy rate of desertions from the armed forces, and he was getting up the facts. He had sent for a mathematician to analyze the data, and he had gotten this gnome. It was all very trying. The gnome, whose name was Professor Smeal, had put together a presentation, which comprised an inordinate number of tables and equations. To make matters worse, the general had spent some time in confusion, until he realized that when Professor Smeal referred to the model, he meant the real world, which he appeared to regard as one of a number of surprising examples of what he called the relation axioms. "Let me see if I understand you correctly," said the general. "The farther any military unit gets from New Gnome, the more men desert from it." "Professor Smeal, in the model you are concerned with, yes, that would obtain." "General McGifford, obtain? Oh, yes, I see, obtain. Now you're sure things get worse and worse as units get farther and farther from the capital, not as units get closer and closer to the enemy." "Professor Smeal, enemy? Ah, yes, yes, yes. What we have called the Gimmel space. It is not a Krausthofer space, you know. Quite different. Quite, quite, quite." "Nope. It doesn't look like Barr's writing got any better in the 8 years between his Alien Human Sex book and his How to Rule a Planet book. One can't help but notice that there are some strange preoccupations of the elder Barr. And what effect did this have on the younger Barr? This is from a Vanity Fair profile of William Barr from October 2019. At one point, the young Barr even declared to his horse man advisor that when he grew up, he wanted to become head of the CIA. Soon after graduation, Barr joined the CIA as a China analyst while attending George Washington University Law at night and married Christine Moynihan, a librarian. According to James Zirin, the legal commentator and former federal prosecutor, Barr is from the school of L'État, c'est moi, I am the state. A man, in the end, not unlike his father. I have to warn you to sort out the wheat from the chaff. The merchants of deceit want to terrify the liberals about the big bad conservative bogeyman, Bill Barr, but it's all a ruse. Barr is on the same side as the globalists, just in a different disguise. But we'll return to Bill Barr a little later. Let's look now at the improbable rise of Jeffrey Epstein. Again, let's go to the paper of record, the New York Times, which is often forced to provide just enough information to raise more questions than they ever choose to answer. He turned up in the gossip columns, but lived a life full of question marks, as New York Magazine put it in 2002. More than one writer likened Mr. Epstein to Jay Gatsby, the enduringly impenetrable F. Scott Fitzgerald character. He was said to look a little like the designer Ralph Lauren, who was born in the Bronx. But Mr. Epstein came from Brooklyn. His father was a City Parks employee. Mr. Epstein took classes in physics at the Cooper Union in the mid-1970s and later attended New York University, but did not receive a degree from either school, New York Magazine reported. He began his career as a math teacher at the Dalton School, an elite private school in Manhattan, whose alumni include the cable news anchor, Anderson Cooper, the comedian Chevy Chase, and the actress Claire Danes. By most accounts, he was something of a Robin Williams in Dead Poets Society type of figure, wowing his high school classes with passionate mathematical riffs, according to the New York Magazine article. I am warning my readers, you need to be careful about such seductive prose. If you're a literary type, they expect you to swoon over the comparison to Jay Gatsby, maybe remembering Robert Redford or Leonardo DiCaprio in the title role of the two movie versions of the book. If you're a fashionista, you have an image of the older-looking, rugged Ralph Lauren in your mind. If you're an educator or academic, you probably list Robin Williams's performance in Dead Poets Society as one of your inspirations for being in the teaching profession. They want to make Epstein the blank screen upon which you project your own personal fantasy of a mysterious New York financier. And if you're a money guy, this is how they make you want to fall in love with Epstein. From there, Dalton, he took his math skills to Bear Stearns, then a powerful Wall Street investment bank. Both New York Magazine and Vanity Fair Magazine reported that he made connections at Dalton that led him to Alan C. Greenberg. Then, the dauntless chief executive of the Wall Street firm Bear Stearns. Known as Ace, Mr. Greenberg was later the firm's chairman and the chairman of its executive committee. Under Mr. Greenberg and another top executive, James Kane, Mr. Epstein did well enough to become a limited partner, a rung beneath full partner, Vanity Fair reported. He left in the early 1980s, forming a consulting firm called International Assets Group that he ran out of his apartment, according to Vanity Fair. Later, he set up a money management firm called J. Epstein & Company. It eventually became the Financial Trust Company, based in the Virgin Islands. This is where I have to start calling bullshit on the New York Times. Does it seem like Epstein just happens to walk between the raindrops and not get wet? Who in the 1980s would set up a consulting firm in their apartment and expect to become successful? Nobody would do that. There's one explanation that makes the most sense to me. Everything about Epstein's rise through the ranks smells of being recruited by an intelligence agency. Who makes the accusation that Jeffrey Epstein was an intelligence asset, aside from Alex Acosta, the former Secretary of Labor in the Trump administration? Epstein's former business partner, Stephen Hoffenberg. The accusation was published in a Rolling Stone article by Vicki Ward, published on July 15, 2021. At the time Ward met Hoffenberg, he was serving time in federal prison. She set the scene. "We sat in a little room near a recreation area, Hoffenberg dressed in the requisite orange jumpsuit, while I, several months pregnant with twins, was dressed per prison requirements, as shapelessly as possible. It was an absolutely intriguing meeting. Hoffenberg was serving 18 years in prison for committing a $450 million Ponzi scheme. In the 1980s, he'd been running Towers Financial, a debt collection and reinsurance business, and had worked alongside Epstein, who was a paid consultant. Hoffenberg told me that Epstein had plans to turn Towers into a global colossus through illegal means. Let's start putting the pieces together. Do spies like to hang out with good, law-abiding citizens? No, they'd like to hang out among the criminals, those who operate in the gray world, able to move between corridors of power and the criminal underworld. Hoffenberg was a perfect mark for Epstein. And do we listen to the criminal, especially after they've been caught? In most cases, we don't, but we should. And Hoffenberg is a prime example of why we should listen. If we want to avoid being fooled again, let the criminal in jail tell you how the world really works." Hoffenberg said that Epstein had a term for the perfect execution of the grift. He called it playing the box, which meant that he ensured that even if his crime was uncovered, the victim would be unable to do anything about it, either because of social embarrassment or because the money was tucked away in a place where they couldn't either find it or get it. What Hoffenberg had failed to realize, he told me, is that Epstein would con him. Epstein would take $100 million of Towers money, move it offshore, and meanwhile cooperate with U.S. prosecutors against Hoffenberg, who was unable to do anything about this because he'd pled guilty, which meant there was no trial, and therefore no discovery. We're getting a little more information about how Epstein worked his dark magic, and yet it's an incomplete picture. It's not bad as an operating system for a criminal, but there is a piece missing. How do you deal with the authorities? The idea that a criminal may seek out vulnerable victims, reluctant to go to the police, isn't an idea that Epstein came up with. Many crooks have pursued a similar strategy, and law enforcement officers have also come up with their countermeasures in such situations. I refuse to accept a view of the world that relies on the main actors to be dumb. Both the cops and criminals are wise to the ways of their enemies. The mafia was able to flourish in America for so long because they had a code of silence, but they were also often paying off the police, the judges, and the politicians. And, as we all know, the U.S. government partnered with the mafia during World War II to help with the invasion of Sicily, as well as in the 1960s to go after Cuba. Getting all, or a portion of, the authorities on your side is a really good play for a criminal. Epstein seems to have done just that, according to the Rolling Stone article. Hoffenberg also knew something else Epstein wanted hidden, according to Hoffenberg. He claimed that Epstein moved in intelligence circles. The story told in the Rolling Stone article begins with a British defense contractor, Douglas Leese, who was suspected of being an arms dealer. I remember distinctly that in our first meeting, Hoffenberg told me that Leese was pivotal in understanding Jeffrey's M.O., because Leese had introduced him not only to aristocratic Europeans, who Epstein subsequently fleeced, but to all sorts of people in the arms business, including the late Turkish-born businessman Adnan Khashoggi, and, allegedly, the late media mogul Robert Maxwell, author's note, father of Ghislaine Maxwell. When the reporter brought up the names Douglas Leese and Robert Maxwell to Jeffrey Epstein, Epstein denied ever knowing them. But that wasn't the story Hoffenberg related. Hoffenberg told me that Epstein had said he'd worked on several projects with Robert Maxwell, including solving Maxwell's debt issues. Maxwell died in 1991 under very strange circumstances, apparently having fallen off his yacht, the Lady Ghislaine, in the middle of the night, and it was discovered in the aftermath that he'd stolen hundreds of millions of dollars from the pensions of his employees. Epstein had also told Hoffenberg that via Maxwell and Leese, he was involved in something that Hoffenberg described as national security issues, which he says involved blackmail, influence trading, trading information at a level that is very serious and dangerous. Was this when Epstein was first introduced to Ghislaine Maxwell, his longtime lover and procurer of young women for him, who is now currently serving a prison term for these crimes? Do you find it odd that Ghislaine is spending time in jail for procuring young women to have sex with powerful men, but no man has been charged with being one of the customers? This is how the encounters with Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell were described by underage Virginia Giuffre in Julie Brown's book, Perversion of Justice, shortly after the first massage, which had involved sexual activity. The massage was the same as the day before, with both Epstein and Maxwell orchestrating the session. Virginia followed their orders like a soldier. She and Maxwell caressed each other, and the three of them began having sex. Virginia soon realized that Epstein had an insatiable sickness that no one person, not even Maxwell, could fulfill. Jeffrey treated us girls like a piece of clothing he could try on for the day and get rid of the next, she would later write in her manuscript. I'm including this material about the sexual depravity of Jeffrey Epstein to let you know how much of a monster he was, but also so you understand that was only part of what he was doing. Epstein was much more than a rich guy using his money to satisfy his sexual desires. It was clear to Virginia that Maxwell was in love with Epstein, but Epstein and Maxwell rarely slept together or shared intimate moments, like holding hands or kissing. Virginia said this was because Maxwell was never able to satisfy Epstein's insatiable appetite for girls. Maxwell came to accept his obsession as long as those encounters remained purely sexual. The two shared a kind of hedonism, Virginia said. It was an arrangement whereby she would bring him the girls, and he would give Ghislaine the kind of self-indulgent life that she was accustomed to growing up. It's clear that Ghislaine was something of a slave to Jeffrey Epstein. But was Epstein working solely for himself, or was he working for somebody else? In order to answer that question, we must understand the twisted path of Ghislaine Maxwell, the youngest daughter of media mogul Robert Maxwell. Sometime on the night of November 4th, 1991, while his yacht was sailing to the end of Tenerife in the Canary Islands, Robert Maxwell went missing. His waterlogged body was soon discovered, and the original autopsy report ruled he died of natural causes of heart and lung failure. Although his family doubted the findings and ordered an additional autopsy, a large funeral was held, and the guest list was quite intriguing. Six current and former heads of Israeli intelligence services attended Maxwell's funeral. Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir eulogized him, describing Maxwell as a person who was greatly interested in the Israeli economy, invested money in Israel, and offered to put his wide contacts on the international arena at Israel's service. Indeed, Maxwell had vast financial dealings in Israel, including a majority share in the Israeli daily newspaper Ma'ariv. He was hailed for opening factories that provided jobs and for having helped pave the way for Israel's interests around the world by cultivating powerful people in politics and business from Moscow to London. He was personal friends with both former U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger and former Russian President Mikhail Gorbachev. But even from the time of his death, there were rumors that he'd been killed by the Israeli Mossad because he had become a liability to them. In their 2003 book, The Assassination of Robert Maxwell, authors Gordon Thomas and Martin Dillion laid out evidence that for two decades, Maxwell was a spy for the Mossad, who profited from disseminating Israeli intelligence gathering computer software to Russia, the U.S., Britain, and other countries. The software was rigged with a mechanism to allow the Mossad to secretly tap into classified information gathered by the world's top intelligence agencies. The authors theorized that Maxwell was murdered because the publishing baron was so desperate to save his fortune that he blackmailed the Mossad, threatening to expose their spy activities if the agency's leaders didn't bail him out of financial ruin. I think I've demonstrated clearly how there are multiple lines of contact that create evidence suggesting that Epstein was an intelligence asset for somebody. Maxwell is a perfect example of big money, media influence, and intelligence connections. Who gets six current and former heads of the Israeli Mossad to show up at their funeral? One might view their appearance as both honoring Maxwell's previous service to the Mossad and also serving as a warning of what might happen to any who would betray them. According to investigative reporter Julie K. Brown, after Maxwell's death, the family was in financial trouble, but a benefactor appeared, described by Elizabeth, Maxwell's widow, as a friend and white knight. Although she declined to identify this person, many claim the signs were clear. But less than 2 weeks after her husband's death, the YIVO Institute for Jewish Research paid tribute to Robert Maxwell, an event that was planned prior to his death to honor both him and his wife for their charitable work. Elizabeth decided to go ahead with attending the event, held at New York's Plaza Hotel on November 24th. Seated next to Elizabeth and Ghislaine at the event was a pudgy man with curly hair who was unknown at the time. His name was Jeffrey Epstein. We have completed the neat little circle of Robert Maxwell, Jeffrey Epstein, and Ghislaine Maxwell. The suspicion of many is that Robert Maxwell was a longtime Mossad agent. Witness six former and current Mossad chiefs at his funeral, in addition to the Prime Minister giving the eulogy. The mysterious death that may or may not have been at the hand of Mossad agents, the financial struggle of the family, and then the sudden appearance of a white knight, a.k.a. Jeffrey Epstein. What happens from here? What is the picture we develop of the mysterious Jeffrey Epstein? One part Robin Williams in Dead Poets Society, one part Ralph Lauren, one part Sexual Svengali, and one part Jay Gatsby. Let's try to put a little more flesh onto the bones of this enigmatic figure, as depicted in best-selling author James Patterson's book on Epstein, Filthy Rich, as seen through the eyes of journalist Vicky Ward. Epstein is charming, but he doesn't let the charm slip into his eyes, she wrote. They are steely and calculating, giving some hint at the steady whir of machinery running behind them. Let's play chess, he said to me, after refusing to give an interview for this article. You be white, you get the first move. It was an appropriate metaphor for a man who seems to feel he can win no matter what the advantage of the other side. His advantage is that no one really seems to know him, or his history completely, or what his arsenal really consists of. He has carefully engineered it so that he remains one of the few truly baffling mysteries among New York's moneyed world. People know snippets, but few know the whole. One powerful investment manager wondered about Epstein's conspicuous absence from New York's trading floors. The trading decks don't seem to know him, he says. It's unusual for animals that big not to leave footprints in the snow. To complete the picture of Epstein, we see him as some sort of predator, and yet nobody genuinely understands the ecosystem in which he operates. The game seems to be bigger than money or sex, and yet it's difficult to see behind the disguise. To get a complete picture of what was happening, I think it's important to realize that multiple parts of the government were in conflict with each other. There were the genuinely good parts of the law enforcement community that were trying to get a wealthy sexual predator off the streets, while in another part of the government, there were likely intelligence assets who wanted to protect one of their own. The prosecution of Epstein seemed at odds with common sense, because it made no sense. There were elements of the government that wanted him in jail, and elements that wanted him out of jail. But since Epstein had obtained a certain level of public visibility, the deep state couldn't simply let him walk. That would make it far too obvious for the public to swallow. But how to make it seem to the public that he was being punished, without letting him be punished? This is how Epstein's time in prison was described in the book, Dead Men Tell No Tales. In truth, Epstein's time behind bars would be more of a retreat than retribution. To start, he was not sent to federal prison like most sex offenders in the state. Instead, he was given a private wing at the Palm Beach County Stockade facility, where he enjoyed the care of his own personal security guards. Even then, remarkably, he spent little time within the confines of the jail. Just over 3 months into his sentence, Epstein was granted work release, allowing him to leave the premises for up to 7 days a week, up to 16 hours at a time. That period included up to 2 hours at his Palm Beach sex den. According to records obtained by these authors, one of his nonprofit organizations paid $128,000 to the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Department to cover the cost of his personal detail. They were even known to refer to him as the client instead of as the perp. Ultimately, Epstein, one of the sickest sex fiends to ever walk the planet, only served 13 months before he was released on good behavior. It's important to have a consistent narrative in your head, because more than anything else, the mainstream media wants you to be confused by the Epstein case. I'm here to make the case as clear as possible. You're supposed to believe that wealth and power in America allows you to buy your way to innocence, even if you're guilty. But Epstein pled guilty. Even if you understand the corruption of our justice system prior to sentencing, you look at the result and see that there was a guilty verdict. All the lawyers in the world couldn't keep Epstein from pleading guilty to something. The justice system then takes over, right? We don't imagine that you can buy your way out of prison, right? That would take more than money. But somehow, Epstein spent a very pleasant 13 months attended by his own security detail free to go where he pleased during the day, and having the sheriff's department treat him like a client rather than a perp. It sounds as if some very powerful people in the shadows were making things tolerable for the convicted pedophile. With that suspicion, let's take a quick detour into a troubling accusation about William Barr, the two-time Attorney General of the United States, under President George H.W. Bush and Donald Trump.